I confess that I had a hard time with this text this week. As Silvio and several others saw me sweating in the college library preparing and working on the sermons this week, I had a nice sermon that was almost ready by Thursday evening. And then Thursday evening, as I was retyping my notes one more time, I realized that I had missed something in the text. And as I started the text, I did what we often do when we see a text like that has a list of things not to do and things that you're supposed to do. And I just started working through the list. And I think one of the reasons we do this sometimes is that probably like me, many of you grew up with the old King James Version. And the old King James Version was really great. I love memorizing text from the King James. And I have to tell you, still today, when I'm driving, when I'm walking, when I'm working, and I'm reciting in my heart and in my head verses that I remember by heart, most of them I've learned from the old King James in English and from the very old Louis Segal in French. And there was a rhyme and a rhythm and a pattern to it. But there was one problem with the old King James Bibles, and the same problem we had with the old Louis Segal 1910. It wasn't set up in paragraphs. Every verse was laid out separately, as if every verse was its own little thought. And that produced some problems sometimes, because when you looked at the scriptures, you would interpret the Bible and read the Bible verse by verse by verse by verse. And the problem with that is that the Bible isn't meant to be read verse by verse by verse by verse. It's meant to be read paragraph by paragraph by paragraph. Because sometimes you read a line that's in the middle of a paragraph, and it seems to say one thing, but you need to understand it by the other words that are around it. I'll never forget, I was teaching a course at Bible school several years ago, and I had a young student who was working on his paper, and he came to see me. He said, "I'm working on my paper," and he says, "I'm working on my footnotes," and he says, "You know, I'm putting in the references of the books that I'm referring to," and he says, "I want to put in the references to the Bible verses that I want to refer to in the text." And he says, "You know, sometimes," he says, "you want to refer to part of a text, like the first half or the second half of a text, and you say like John 3:16a or John 3:16b. And he says, "I want to quote the middle part of a verse. There's three sentences in the verse, and I want to quote just the middle sentence. How do I do that?" And I say, "Well, just quote the whole verse." And he says, "No, I don't want to do that, because the whole verse doesn't say what I want it to say. I just want the middle sentence that says what I want it to say." And this is often what we've done with the Bible. We've gone through a verse at a time and lifted the verse out of context, and that creates some problems. I've told you many times, and I was telling them again a couple of Wednesday evenings ago, that I always have a bit of a chuckle and then a bit of chagrin when I see the way people quote the book of Job. In the book of Job, we get three or four chapters into the book of Job, and then Job's three friends show up, and they give him all kinds of advice. And for about 25 chapters, Job's three friends give him all kinds of advice about what he should do in his suffering. And after they've gone on for 25 chapters of advice, God appears, and he tells Job's three friends, "You know what? You guys are completely wrong. You have no idea what you're talking about." And so basically God says, for the last 25 chapters, what you've been saying doesn't make much sense. And so we go into the middle of the book of Job, and we quote from some of those chapters in the book of Job where God has said, "You guys aren't making much sense." Now in the text today, there's a list of things that we should not do anymore, and there's a list of things that we should do. And I don't want to just give you the list, because too often we come to church and that's what we get. Because we feel bad when we leave, because the pastor has reminded us again that there's 17 things that we do that we shouldn't be doing, and there's a dozen things that we aren't doing that we should be doing. And we go out and we feel kind of crummy, because we know we're still doing too many things we shouldn't be doing, and we're not doing enough of the things we should be doing. So we need to step back from this passage a little bit to understand what's going on. Just a few moments ago, I told the children about being a steward, about what you're going to do with that $100 bill, about what you would do if somebody... Did he give that back to me? Yeah, he did. I still have it. Okay, good. I'm a little nervous. I'm sorry. I don't normally carry that much money on me. I'm a pastor, after all. You know. And the heart of the text, as the text draws to a close, God tells us, Peter tells us rather, about what God has entrusted to us. about the grace of God that has been entrusted to us. And that grace that we have been given changes our lives. It changes the way we respond to suffering and adversity. It changes the way we face tough circumstances. It changes the way we respond to people on the outside of these walls. And it changes the way we treat people who are inside these walls with us. There's a funny start at the beginning of the section. It says that those who have suffered in the flesh have done away with sin. And I got to tell you, when I read that, it really hooked me. And I thought, wait a minute. I've suffered in the flesh, but I still screw up. I still sin. I wonder what Peter's saying. Peter is saying that there are a lot of us, we used to live a life where we ran after the pleasures of the flesh. Good food, good wine, all. There's nothing wrong with those things in and of themselves, but that becomes your lifestyle. You live for the moment. Peter describes these as people who live in the flesh, going after human passions. They live for sensuality, for passions, for drunkenness, for orgies, for drinking parties, for lawless idolatry. The things that you touch and feel and taste, that's what's important. That's what they want. That's what they lead their lives for. And something happens to you and I as believers after we come to Christ and we realize that this world isn't always a friendly place. And we realize that as Christians and as believers, we live in a world that is tangible, that is physical, that we touch, that we feel, and that we see. But this world that we touch and feel and see is not always friendly to our faith. In fact, usually when we live our lives as we should as believers, this world of things that we touch and feel and see, this very present world of food and money and drink and pleasure and parties and all of this is very much counter to our faith. And we realize that these things are not our friends. And when we realize that these things are not our friends, we can't enjoy them the way we used to. And the funny thing is that the people around us who invite us to do all of these things that they do and the parties and going to bed with whoever you want at the office at the drop of a hat and all of these immoral things that they do, they think these things are so much fun. They want you to go with them and they don't get it. They don't understand. And it's funny, the Greek actually uses the word run. They run after these things. They can't wait. They just can't get enough. And they're always going after it. And they're having a good time. And that's what it's about. And they want you to go and have a good time with them. And for you, it's just not a good time. This is not what a good time is anymore. And they don't get it. They don't understand. They don't understand why you don't get pleasure out of all this stuff that they find so entertaining. They don't understand that you found something more precious and more valuable and more important to you. And because you don't run with them in these things, the text says they malign you. They say bad things about you. And you know why they do that. I told you last week that when somebody is having fun in sin, doing all the stuff they shouldn't be doing, you don't need to say a word. All you need to do is to refuse to do those things with them, and they get upset at you because you're making them feel bad. They don't just want you not to judge them. They don't want you to just keep quiet about what your morality is. They want you to do the same stuff that they're doing. Otherwise, they're going to feel bad that they're doing that stuff, and you're not doing it. And so don't feel bad when you get ostracized and maligned. It's not because you're doing something wrong. It could be just the fact that you are who you are as a believer, as a child of God, living your life the way you're supposed to live it. Sometimes just the fact of doing that without a word, without speaking judgment, without any attempt, just by being who you are as a believer, living the life you're called to live, you are a difficulty for the people around you who live the wild life. And Peter says, don't worry about them. One day they will be judged. One day they will be judged. So what about you then? If you don't live that way, how do you live? Well, you've been entrusted this grace. And usually we're too restrictive about the grace that God has given to us. There's this grace that God has given to us, and it's about our redemption. There's this great story of our redemption, of what God has done for us through Jesus Christ, about how he's paved the way for us to inherit these eternal riches, to be with God in glory. And we think about the grace of God to us as being that redemption. And it is, but it is so much more. And so he says, as you live your Christian life, as you learn to take that grace and that love and that kindness and that mercy that God has poured into your life, how do you live that out? How do you live that? It's more than just coming to worship on Sunday and being thankful for what God has given you. It should overflow to the people around you. And Peter takes just 3 or 4 examples of the way you do this. He says, above all, keep loving one another earnestly. And I love what he says here. He says, since love covers a multitude of sins. Isn't that a strange expression? You know what that means? I really love my wife. And you know, sometimes my wife uses my good Mastercraft flathead screwdriver as a multi-purpose tool to open a can of coffee. And the tool man in me wants to go, yes, that's why they make a lifetime warranty, absolutely. And Debbie really loves me. And she loves me so much that sometimes things get really busy. And I know you won't believe that I would ever do this, but on the day of her anniversary, I accepted to officiate the funeral at Mount Royal. I don't know any pastors who would do this, but it happens. Love covers a multitude of sins. And we come together in the fellowship of brothers and sisters, and we want to sit there and nitpick about the one whose shoes aren't quite right, about the one who sings a little off key and throws us when we try to sing on Sunday morning, about all the little things that bug us, but all the little sins. And Peter says, when the love is big enough, it covers a multitude of little things that you just forgive, that you just let slip, that you probably don't even mention. And yes, this is true in a larger sense, that the love of God shown through Jesus Christ, through the redemption that we've got at the cross, covers a multitude of sins. But that's the easy part of it. The hard part is, day to day, brothers and sisters, we live together and we love each other enough that we pass over the little sins. And then he says, show hospitality to one another without grumbling. There were believers who were struggling financially. There were believers who'd lost their jobs because they were Christians. There were believers who'd lost their jobs because there was a very difficult moment in the empire. There's a famine that struck Jerusalem and that spread through other areas of the Roman Empire. And so there was a long stretch of time where when the early church practiced love and hospitality one to another, you remember early on in the book of Acts, it says that because some of them were poor, they sold some property and they used the money to take care of each other and they fed other people. And there's a lot of Christians who were lucky enough to own a house and they had a couple of people living with them in their spare room and a few people sleeping on the couch. And if they were lucky enough to be graced by God to have money, often there'd be other people with them at their dining room table and they'd be feeding not only themselves but a couple of other people with $100 that's burning a hole in their pocket. And Peter says, you got to do that without grumbling. It's hard to do this, isn't it? And then Peter says, as each one of you has received a gift. Now, please notice that he doesn't word it conditionally. He says, if each one of you has received a gift. And he doesn't say, now those of you who have received a gift. He says, as each has received a gift. There's no conditional. You're a brother and sister in Christ. You're a child of God. You're redeemed. You have received a gift. You've been given something, a skill, an ability, something that you have been given. and it isn't for you. As each has received a gift, use it to serve one another as good stewards of varied grace. Now, there's a couple of things. I have this conversation with a lot of people. There's a couple of things that I really struggle with that I don't think I do very well. And I warned the search committee when we started. Those of you on the search committee may remember all the way back 6.5 years ago. But there's a couple of things where I think God uses me a little bit. And I think teaching is one of them. Now imagine if I forgot the fact that my gift of teaching was for you. What if I thought that my gift of teaching was just for me? I like teaching. It's a lot of fun. So on Thursday morning at 4:30 in the morning, I'm going to be preaching every week from the pulpit. It's going to be fun. It's going to be great. I like to teach. Would be kind of pointless, right? Because none of you are here. Now, there's a couple of you thinking, I wish he preached on Thursday morning at 4:30 in the morning. That way we wouldn't have to listen to him on Sunday morning. Okay, that's fine. We could have a chat later. But you understand, the gift that you've been given is not for you. It's for the other people. And so as you do that, as you think through your gift, there's a bunch of questions you ask. Am I teaching in a way that's helping other people? If I'm teaching every Sunday and a bunch of people come and, hypothetically come and say to me, you talk too fast and we can't follow you, then you might want to have to learn to slow down a little bit and write it in your notes that you need to slow down when you preach. And he gives some examples. Whoever speaks, if that's your gift, you should speak as if you're speaking for God. Whoever serves, you should serve as one who serves by the strength that God supplies. Whatever it is you've been given as a gift, whatever it is that you've been given to do, do it with your whole heart, do it to the best of your ability, remembering that you're doing it for other people in order, and here's the goal, in order that in everything God may be glorified through Jesus Christ. God, who has poured out his abundant grace and mercy and love into us. Actually, that's the wrong word. God has not poured out his amazing and abundant grace, love, and mercy into us. He has poured it through us. Do you understand the difference? God hasn't placed his grace in us. He sent it through us. You're not a pot, you're a pipe. You're not a bucket, you're a canal. Over the last couple of years, as they have been redoing the water system in the city of Montreal, we've got some challenges in this city. There are a lot of old roads and a lot of old pieces of infrastructure in the city of Montreal. When Debbie and I were worshiping at the Church of St. Andrew and St. Paul, there was a problem with the water conduit that takes fresh water from the main street to the church. And they had to dig it up to fix it. And they made an interesting discovery. When they first started supplying fresh water around Montreal, they buried all kinds of tubes and pipes under the streets to bring fresh water. And when the city was first built and they first started bringing fresh water underground, they used tree trunks. They used cedars, large cedar tree trunks. They hollowed out the inside and they connected the trees one to another, and this is how the water was supplied. There are still about 700 or 800 kilometers of water conduit under the streets of Montreal that are still old, hollowed out cedar trees with the fresh water running through them. They use birch because it resists the water underground. And then when they ran out of cedars that were available here locally, they went to clay pipe. Well, pieces of clay pipe get very brittle with the cold, and there's heave and thaw. And so the water main that was going into the Church of St. Andrew and St. Paul, after years of people running on the street over ground, this large cedar tree trunk had become crushed, and there wasn't a lot of water still coming through it. So as they're digging under the streets of Montreal, they're having to replace a bunch of these old water pipes. Here's a statistics for those of you that like statistics. I'll give you two of them. 4,300 kilometers. That is the length of freshwater pipes buried under the streets of Montreal. There's 4,300 kilometers of pipes that bring fresh water from the main water treatment plant to your house into my house. And some of those are old hollowed out tree trunks. Some of those are pieces of clay pipe. And some of them are broken lead pipes. I hope you're not in one of those neighborhoods, but there's still some neighborhoods where your fresh water is brought to you in a lead pipe. If you're going a little crazy on Friday afternoon after your fifth glass of water, you might know why. And as they were digging through this, about 20 years ago, they decided to do a study on how much of the water was actually getting through. And so when they started for the first time to put water meters in different areas of the city, we're able to estimate when the water leaves the water treatment plant, when the fresh water was leaving one of the three large water treatment plants in Montreal, and when it was going into these fresh water pipes to bring it to your house and to your restaurant and to your school and to your business, they managed to figure out about how much of it was getting through to the end. Do you know what the number was? 30%. 30%. In other words, for every 10 liters of fresh water that they were pouring into the end of the pipe, there was only 3 liters of fresh water getting to, there was 70% loss underground in broken pipes in all of this going on. Now, if you think that's bad, I've got a worse percentage for you. 100% of Christians, of you and I, are a pipe that has been filled with the fresh, life-bringing water of the grace and love and mercy of God. And most of us aren't pipes that lets the fresh water through to somebody else. Most of us are pots and buckets that sit there and just drink it in, and drink it in, and drink it in, and drink it in, and drink it in. This is not right. This is not right. There are people around you in your neighborhood, in your family, in your community, in your city, who are longing, thirsting, who are quenched for just a sip of fresh, life-changing water come from God. And you're the pipe. You're the canal. You're the conduit that's going to bring it to them. God's grace has not been poured into us. God's grace has been poured through us. We are not owners of that $100 bill in the envelope. We are stewards. The grace of God is not ours to keep and hoard. The grace of God is ours to share. Amen.